Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
We now speak with psychiatrist and avid gardener Sue Stewart Smith. And as we know here in Utah, connection with nature is part of our mental health. Gardening can accomplish that with nature connection in spades. From digging into the earth and feeling in it between our fingers, seeing the results of our efforts, and when we see vegetables or flowers grow, we convene with nature through gardening as a healing and restorative process. Sue will tell us how and why. Thank you for joining us, Sue.
Hello, Pete. Hello, Lynn. Very pleased to be with you today.
Oh, it's great to have you. We have an international cornucopia of guests today, so thank you.
And yes, I could hear your previous guest. He had a lovely Scottish accent.
And where are you from?
I'm from the south of England.
Excellent.
So we live in Hertfordshire, which is just north of London.
And did you?
And I grew up in the south part of the north part of the country.
Did you grow up gardening? Is it a lucrative, wonderful gardening geography there?
Do you know what? But I married someone who was a very keen gardener in our mid-20s, and he just setting out here as a landscape architect and garden designer. And I was at that point a medical student. I hadn't really finished my medical training. And we started creating a garden together. And this is over 30 years ago now, around a barn, which is where we live, in what was a field. And that's how my love of gardening developed. So I came at it really knowing very, very little. And the excitement, I think, it's a very slow process creating a place, but ultimately we created a garden where we feel rooted, we connected with the place, and gradually I got more and more. I started doing all the vegetable gardening, and I just loved growing things from seed. For me, that still gives me a real thrill, a real buzz, the sort of magic of a seed germinating. So that's how it started, really.
So you are not an indigenous gardening expert. You didn't grow up as a gardener, but you married into it and have created a passion. Tell us about your own restorative process how you became rooted and how you became connected with the earth and how it helped you.
Great deal, but in a very subtle way. And it was only looking back a bit later in life that I realized how much that process had been helpful, because quite soon after we moved here, we started having children. We've got three children. My father had died. He died young. He died at 87. He died when I was 21. My mother was still alive, but somewhere inside me I was still struggling to come to terms with that loss. And the whole process of attaching to place, actually, was very, very helpful. I only really noticed it, the therapeutics of gardening myself, a bit later on when I was further on in my psychiatry training and career and was carrying more responsibility at work. And I began to notice that through particularly weeding, just simple methodical jobs in the garden at weekends, how much my mind would sort of clear and how just the sense of sort of relaxation would come over me. And that whole thing of slowing down to the garden pace, and really enjoying, I think, just the sense of other life around me. You know, being a doctor is a very indoors life, and actually being a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, you really stay in one room a lot of the time, so you don't even get to walk around the hospital much. So it was a very good counterpoint for that. That was the point at which I began to think, oh, you know what, this isn't just about making a place more beautiful, you know, creating, growing food and veg for us to eat. This is really doing something for me as well.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Sue Stewart Smith. She's written a new book called The Well-Gardened Mind, The Restorative Power of Nature. And you, in your book, Sue, tell a lot of stories about people that you've known and that you found through your research. And you dig into that psychological benefit of growing plants. And as you say, you know, it's a meditation, it's an escape, it's something that I think we often discover along the way. I know I've found it myself. Our sprinkler system is on the fritz, and Well, it has been for like a handful of years. And I water with the hose. I water the whole yard, front and back, with a hose. I do it at sunset or at sunrise. And I have realized I will never replace it with a sprinkler system because it is my meditation. And I love it. It's funny how we stumble upon these things.
It is. And I have to say, I stumbled on exactly the same thing in my own sort of gardening journey. You know, there was a point where I was always kind of trying to get jobs done in the garden in a hurry. You know, and part of that was just symptomatic of, you know, having a career and children and a busy life. But particularly something like watering, I absolutely made a rule for myself not rush through it and to really attend in quite a sort of, if you listen to the sound of the water and you watch the kind of droplets of the leaves of the plant, the whole thing becomes quite a transformative experience. And you end up feeling quite refreshed yourself, you know. So I think gardening is like a lot of things. It's not what you do, it's often how you do them. So there is something very important about taking time actually to really connect and using your senses, using all our senses with the garden, because it's a fantastic sensory environment.
Absolutely. Talk about community gardens, especially those in inner city school districts that are popping up. You have a piece with Christiane Amanpour and another gentleman who directs a lot of these community gardens. And I'm wondering about the benefits, the psychological and psychiatric benefits of children, especially in inner city schools, gardening.
I think it can't be underestimated, actually. You're talking about Ron Finley, aren't you, the gangster gardener?
Yes.
And he appears in my book, and you're right, I was on the Christiane Amanpour show with him. His mission, one of his missions, is to make gardening cool for kids. And that discovery, you know, that you can, through sowing a seed, a very simple act, you know, a few months later, be sharing a great pumpkin or squash or, you know, that you could grow some wonderful, wonderful flowers, nasturtiums or whatever, brightly coloured flowers. You know, that can be a real revelation for a child. And I think it's very helpful to also recognise that we're part of this. We have our human lives and we're so wrapped up in them, but we are part of a great web of life, you know, an ecosystem. And you just begin to tune into that, really, and notice, and, you know, all the birds, the insects. There's so much, you know, if children can be awakened to it. Most children experience real sense of joy in nature. It needs to be made fun to begin with, I think.
What about those times when things aren't so successful and you don't see the growth or the connection and all of your plants die or freeze at night, or you live in Utah and you're at 6,500 feet and you can barely grow lettuce sometimes? Talk to us a little bit about how do you incorporate that into your concepts?
I think is to adapt what you're trying to do to the climate and the soil that you're situated in. So you know that you can't force nature to do something that doesn't come naturally to the plants. So you have to work with nature. You have to understand it as a partnership, really. It's not about us trying to, force or dominate nature to perform. So I think that's the first thing. The other thing I think is always hedge your bet, you know, and something I learned in the vegetable garden, you know, we have plagues, slugs sometimes, and they can destroy a lot of lettuces very quickly. So I always keep some back in the greenhouse. And I grow other crops too, so that you know, if one thing is a disaster, there'll be something else. There'll be a compensation somewhere else. I think that's another. It's just another very useful thing to sort of help cushion those awful moments, which are horrible. But fundamentally, I think that part of the fascination of gardening is that we're not completely in control. That you know, that it's very empowering to grow, to produce produce, to have a harvest, or to flowers that, you know, that you can give to somebody and they say, "Oh, wow, you grew those." That's very empowering, very good for self-esteem. But we're never completely in control of that process, and that's actually very healthy psychologically, because that's true of all relationships in life. And gardening is a relationship.
Yeah, that's what I was, as a parent, you know, we are trying to garden successfully, I'm not sure. And that's one of the things that we try to teach our kids is, you know, sometimes you can give a lot of TLC to these plants, but they're either not a right fit or, you know, things happen and they get really upset. Sometimes my youngest will cry because he's the one that does all the watering and he's got a big heart like his mother. And so it's teaching him resilience as well as compassion and connectivity.
These are really big life lessons and important ones, whatever age you are. And you know, one of the phrases that's used on projects for at-risk youth is transferable skills. So that, you know, when somebody in their teens spends a year on a garden project, I'm talking about the kind of kids who may have been excluded from school, who've never had a feeling of succeeding at anything. You know, because you don't get instant success at the start. That's real. That's real life, isn't it? And because you always get a mixture. Some things will work, some things will thrive, some things won't. And you have to learn to take the rough with the smooth and take from your success. So they don't really try and learn. They go, right, you know, what did I do wrong? Is that the wrong plant? Did I overwater it? You know, it's a great tool for living, really.
I just wanted to bring up, it's an interesting phenomenon. Here in Park City, the trees that we have more than any others are aspen trees, and they're beautiful. And as you probably know, you know, an aspen grove is one large organism that is interconnected in the root system. And this summer, and this has been happening over the last handful of years, if you go to an area, we have a big meadow that's at about 8,500 feet, where you'll see nothing but aspens. And you look across it right now, and a lot of the leaves came out, and then there's some sort of aphid, or I'm not sure what it is, but all of the leaves have died and fallen off these beautiful aspen trees. And here we're only at mid-July. And I look across and it gives me this sense of, it's like this grief and this loss and this feeling of, I'm not going to come up with the right word, but I think even especially in this time of the COVID crisis where you feel like all is lost, all is lost. It sounds a little dramatic, but I get that feeling. And I think it's about the connectedness to nature that you feel and the grief that you can feel. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think nature gives us all sorts of symbols, doesn't it? So it gives us symbols of loss and decay and dying on the one hand, and it gives us tremendous symbols of regeneration. So and again, you know, you can't have one without the other. I can see how very redolent that is at the moment in this crisis, because for the most part, because lockdown, you know, in the US and here has coincided with spring and summer, we've for the most part been able to really draw great hope and strength and a sense of optimism from the unfolding of spring and the beauty of spring. So I suppose the other thing is that the trees, they will recover, I think. We've had some outbreaks of one is a moth, actually, which has affected some of our trees. And you know, I kind of think, you know, trees have a remarkable capacity to come back. So I hope next summer you'll be looking at them and drawing great strength from them.
It's especially heartbreaking, though, when you name, you have a tree dedicated and then it happens. So
yes.
To be patient and to wait
very,
that out.
Very difficult, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We did an interview a couple weeks ago, and it was about, it was called The Wisdom Years, and it was about sort of how to leave a legacy for yourself, and how to explore creativity and things that nurture you in, you know, over 60, when you're over 60. And it made me think about my mother, who has been the avid gardener. Literally, she's 80 years old, and she will spend 8 hours a day out in her garden every day in the summer. And I think it's kept her young, and it really came to light for me during that interview about, you know, how much it has nurtured her soul and kept her young and kept her bright and active and smart. And I just wanted to bring that up because of, well, the importance that you're bringing to us about gardening.
I think that's a wonderful, wonderful example that you've given. It's a lovely story. And, you know, gardening for older people has been shown in really quite a large number of studies now to improve mental health, you know, decrease the risk of Alzheimer's, for example, as well. And improve physical health as well. But I think one thing that happens when we're gardening is we're actually taking quite a lot of exercise and increasing mobility and so on. But you don't think of it as exercise. It's not like, you know, you're not counting the minute in the way you might if you had to do a class or a gym. You know, it's gardening time, and you get caught up in what you're doing. The other really important thing in old age, I think, an older age, but actually also at any time, particularly when life is very uncertain, is the forward-looking nature of gardening, is that we've always got something we're aiming for. And, you know, even as the seasons change and year comes to a close, you can start planning for the following spring. So that capacity to keep looking forward is enormously helpful. And I don't know if you remember in the book I quote this really extraordinary statistic from the Harvard Grant study, which is one of the largest studies of aging and longest running as well that's ever been conducted. And what they found was that people who found ways of being creative in their cities, they used the word generativity, actually, being generative. So it wasn't only about being creative, but it was about passing things on to the next generation or investing in the future through various hobbies and developing skills and so on. And one of the most important of those is gardening. What they found is that people who did that in their 50s were three times more likely to be thriving in their when they reached 80. And that was even after they'd factored in and corrected for economic situation and physical health as well. So I don't think we can't underestimate how important that sense of purpose and motivation that a garden can give you.
Well, thank you so much, Sue Stewart-Smith. We really appreciate your inspiration and your illustrations to help all of us thrive in a new pandemic world to cope with our mental health through gardening and the restorative power of nature, as you say in your book, The Well-Gardened Mind. We look forward to continuing to garden here in our communities and creating lush, beautiful English gardens here at 8,000 feet. Perhaps, maybe not. But again, thank you for joining us.
Excellent. Thank you,
Sue. Thank you for having me. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes.
Yes, and it's probably worth saying the book is also available as an audio book and an e-book as well as a hardback.
That is very worth it. People can listen to it while they're gardening.
Yes, perfect.
They can, and some people, the book came out a few months ago here, and some people have been doing that.
Excellent.
And really, really enjoying that.
All right. Thank you, Sue.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And that's a lovely book.